thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
You know,
here's John Williams.
I want to protest today's weather triangulation game with me, John Williams. Hi, we're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Ave. We'll be here all the way until 3 o'clock. A really busy show planned, some dynamite guests. I don't know if you've been following the news, but this health care bill is making headlines once again. Another one? Jimmy Kimmel had some very interesting things to say about it in a monologue. You may agree with what he said, you may disagree with what he said, but Jimmy comes to it from a very personal place. His son recently had open heart surgery. Doctors saved the boy's life. Jimmy felt fortunate enough to have the insurance and the personal funds to make sure that his son got the best health care. He said nobody should be denied that because they don't have it. So he's been kind of on the forefront of health insurance and the various bills that try and get through the House and Senate. So he monologued the other night about what's happening right now. What we're going to do on the show today is play about three or four clips from Jimmy Kimmel the other night. Was it last night, Elif, that he went on this rant? Or was it the night before? We'll play...
Let me find out.
...the clips from Jimmy Kimmel, and then ask another one of our expert friends, Elizabeth Rosenthal, the editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health, to comment on the clips as they go along. Because Kimmel says that the new bill is actually worse than the ones we've rejected and worse than what we've got. But he's emotionally invested in this. Is he right? We'll try and answer those questions. If you haven't Googled it yet, Google Kimmel, healthcare, lie, whatever you want. But you'll find it out there. It's on the front page of CNN right now, for that matter. We'll play some of the clips and then ask Kaiser Health to sort of keep score for us on that. That will be in our 2 o'clock hour. Also on my Facebook page, I posted the other day what I think is one of the most enjoyable things on TV right now. It's that commercial for Aldi food stores where the two, that looks like maybe mid-20s, I'll guess roommates. One is sitting in front of the TV eating the less expensive version of Aldi mac and cheese. And her roommate comes in, and her little roommate's kind of dolled up, looks like she's going out. They're both wearing chokers. And the dialogue between the two women goes like this.
And I like this organic mac and cheese.
Is that my mac and cheese?
Is that my belt?
Is that my perfume?
Is that my bronzer?
Is that my choker?
Is that my choker?
Are those my bangs from 3 years ago?
Is that my earring in your nose?
Winning tastes so good.
You'll like them both, but love our price.
That is the best thing. Every time that ad comes on, I absolutely focus in on it and I watch everything about it. I love the clothes. I love the interplay. I love the timing. I love the writing. It took me a long time to even know what they were selling me. I was just so enjoying the comedy of this thing. I love that ad. I mean, and I don't even know when it's going to come on. You're just sitting there watching your show, slogging through whatever it is you're watching. And then it's just like a little light comes on your Christmas tree that you didn't know was there. And you go, oh, that illuminates the room so nicely. Thank you. That's how I feel about the Aldi mac and cheese ad. But there's another commercial on TV now that I'm really enjoying. And it's the one for the Toyota Camry, the 2018 Toyota Camry, with a whole slew of safety features. And in this one, you see a family driving down the road. The dad's really grinding out the Camry because there's nothing sexier or faster than a Camry. And as they're going down the winding road, a deer jumps out, and they almost have a crash running into the vehicle in front of them. Over all of that, or underneath all of that, is a version of Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see the moon for me and you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
I want the whole version of that song. And you can go down a rabbit hole of What a Wonderful World versions and never come out. So I posted it on Facebook and I said, I will give a Lou Malnati's pizza to the person that can find me the link to this version of that song. And I got all of a sudden people clicking right away going, here it is, here it is. And all of them are wrong. I mean, they're wrong because I don't want Louis Armstrong. I don't want this woman doing that song with a guitar or a piano. And somebody said, well, that's absolutely Roxette. And somebody else says, no, that's Cat Somebody Somebody. And somebody else says, no, that's Gina Somebody Somebody. And I appreciate the effort, but I want the a cappella version of What a Wonderful World as sung in the Toyota commercial without the sounds of the Toyota engine. You know, I don't want a 39. I want the whole two-minute thing unedited from that woman doing it that way. Now, that may not exist. Maybe she recorded that song specifically for the commercial. But what often happens in these cases is that they will find a seldom seen or little known version of a song, and then it becomes famous because it's in the commercial. My guess is that there is a full-blown version of this. So I Googled who sang the song in the 2018 Camry commercial, What a Wonderful World. And then you get answer boards, and everybody's doing what my Facebook page is doing right now, trying to figure it out, and nobody seems to know. It's so frustrating when the internet, the all-powerful internet, with a very specific charge, cannot get you the exact answer you want. And then you look up, and it's an hour and a half later, and you've been watching What a Wonderful World, and then you find yourself watching old Toyota commercials, and that links you to old Chevy ads, and suddenly you're watching a Bruce Springsteen concert for reasons you can't even remember. So I said, let's just unleash the interweb on this. I'm King John on Facebook, and there's the commercial. And if you can tell me, if you can give me the link to the original of this song, of this girl singing this song, I'll give you a Lou Malnati's pizza. Play the song one more time, Elif, from the ad.
I see trees of green, red roses too.
Isn't that nice?
I see the moon for me.
How nice it would be without all those sound effects.
I did not get that campaign.
What don't you not like about the commercial? They didn't run into the deer or the mobile home in front of them because they're driving a Camry.
It took me about four different songs. Oh, that's the one. That's not the one where the cars were stationary and it was the wheels.
They were doing the song. That's pretty cool, too.
Oh, I didn't get that at all.
It's the wheels on the car as it accelerates or at a higher pitch, and they have it actually performing. Oh, what song is that? Yeah, I just saw that the other day.
It was different songs throughout the Grammys.
Oh, was that?
The Emmys,
oh, yeah. That's right. It was on the Emmys. It was on the Emmys telecast. Yeah. I thought that was pretty clever. I don't remember the songs or the ad or the car. That's kind of a problem if you're the sponsor.
Yeah, I thought actually that's what you were. I thought that's what this was.
No, this is just. I just want the. What a lovely version of that lovely song.
Oh yeah, I have that at home.
You do not. I love it. Somebody on my Facebook page said, "Oh, that's Louis Armstrong. What a Wonderful World." I know that's the song she's covering. I need the link to the original of her doing that version of that song. And if you can do that, I will gift you a Lou Malnati's pizza. Jason, this is John. You're on WGN. Hi, Jason.
Hey, John. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for calling. What can you do for me?
Hey, I'm glad you're back on WGN.
As am I. Thank you.
I talked to you years and years ago, and long before the Cubs won the World Series, you had a thing about what would you give to see the Cubs win the World Series. I'm the guy that would give up his summer. Remember?
No, I remember the question. I don't remember the answer. You would give up summer?
Yeah, I would give up my summer to see the Cubs win the World Series. So I'm ready to give it up. They just need to tell me when.
Yeah, no kidding.
So anyhow, I'm listening to you, and I know Bill and Wendy had a girl by the name of Haley Reinhardt on their show a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And I don't know because I haven't checked, but the clip that you sound that you played sounds an awful lot like her.
Wow. Well, all right. I will Google Haley Reinhardt, What a Wonderful World, and see if that comes up somehow.
Okay.
It's not Louis Armstrong?
Shut up, Steve. I'll tell you what. And Jason, hold on a second. I'll get your number off the air. And if that's what it is, I'll send you the Lou Malnati's pizza, okay?
Oh, yeah, cool. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Patricia, it's John. How are you?
Fine, King John. How are you?
Good. What can you do for us here?
Well, I can't give you the answer you're looking for. However, last night on America's Got Talent, one of the finalists, she's a young girl. I think she's only 13. She sang that song a cappella, and her father just passed away. And it was a version that will give you goosebumps upon goosebumps.
How about that? Oh, I'll look for that. I'm sure that's not what I'm talking about, but and she sang it a cappella, huh?
Yep.
Is that where you sing to yourself in bed at night, a cappella?
Right. Not if you sleep under my pillow.
I'll listen for it, Patricia. Thanks for the heads up on that.
You're welcome, John.
Have a good day. One other TV note. It was on yesterday's show that we were talking a little bit about Ken Burns' Vietnam. Watched another 90 minutes of it last night, Steve. I don't want to say it this way, but I'm a little bit proud of myself. Every time I get through another episode of Ken Burns' Vietnam, I'm behind one. Three have aired, and I've watched two. But still, that's 3 hours of me learning about the history of the Vietnam War that you don't have. And here's the problem when you're watching this thing. You find yourself getting, because you know how this story ends, really angry at the players. Angry at Kennedy. Angry at Nixon. Lord, angry at Johnson. Angry at the French. I mean, were you watching Ken Burns' Vietnam, 3 hours of which are so far about the backdrop of the American experience there? And did you find yourself saying, we knew we were idiots, but what's with the French? Why did the French want to control Vietnam, for crying out loud? Why did they want to have their sons and daughters die over there? It just makes no sense. And when the French move out, they go, okay, we're done. It's sort of like the Soviets in Afghanistan. The United States is too quick to raise its hand and go, I'm in, my turn, woohoo! And it's first its advisors, and then it's advisors and funds, then it's advisors, funds, and tanks, then it's more advisors, funds, and more tanks, and then it's aerial assistance, and it just kept escalating until you went from some civilians in 47 to 58,000. 58,000. And you're watching this thing unfold, and you want to yell, stop, or, oh, my God, what are you, how did, are you kidding me? Here's one thing you can't know about it, and that is, looking at it now and seeing the futility of it all, we realized that we'd made mistakes. But what if we'd backed off and never committed troops and the dominoes fell? What if that did become a giant red dot on the map?
Right, and we're talking about the mid to late 50s, right, with the French?
Uh-huh.
And that's 10 years after World War II.
Right.
That's the very beginning of the Cold War.
Yeah.
With, I'm sure that they've talked about, like, George Kennan, right, and the principles of, you know, the creating a wall and not letting them expand at all.
Right.
It was, you know, that was our mindset then. And, hey, maybe it worked because the Soviet Union then 30 years later did go away.
Right. So if we did, so we eliminated the USSR. And maybe we contained expansionist China or the Russians, the Soviets. I mean, who knows what kind of world we would live in today if, in fact, they dominated that part of the world and we're now living in a world that had Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia all within the Chinese or Russian Empire.
Or even if that was a setback of the overall strategy turned out to be a correct one, right? So not every Sunday is a win, but you still won the season by having that containment strategy.
Yeah, but are you suggesting that so there's some icing on the Vietnam cake, that we, that those 58,000 lives were well spent or spent for some good reason?
Well, I'm not going to say how any life is spent, but I'm just saying that at the time, and I'm not excusing it, I haven't seen the show, but you know, you have to put yourself back where they were then. And where they were then was, you know, just after Joseph Stalin, Nikita Khrushchev leading, and yeah, the Soviet Union on the march.
Well, it's like Donald Rumsfeld said. This would be, what would this be, Steve? Would this be a known unknown? It's, we know that we don't know what would have happened. Is that a known unknown? I mean, really, my point is that,
well, we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah, well, that'd be an unknown unknown.
That's an unknown known.
Anyway, so yesterday then somebody called in and they said, well, he was angry at something that was said at the beginning of the show. And that was, again, knowing about the futility that we expect from this series, because we know how the Vietnam War ends for the United States and the world. There was a line or two in the beginning of it where they talked about the intentions of the United States. And it stuck with one of our listeners so much that he just called yesterday. And I knew the exact line he was talking about. I want to play that for you in a minute.
America's involvement in Vietnam began in secrecy. It ended 30 years later in failure, witnessed by the entire world.
And what did you see, my darling?
It was begun in good faith by decent people out of fateful misunderstandings, American overconfidence, and Cold War miscalculation. And it was prolonged because it seemed easier to muddle through than admit that it had been caused by tragic decisions made by five American presidents belonging to both political parties.
So if somebody asks you, why do we get into the Vietnam War and what was it? There's about as concise an explanation as you can find. He describes it as a failure versus a defeat, and he says we began it in good faith. Doug, you're on WGN. How are you, Doug? What did you want to say? You're on the air.
Yeah, John, how are you doing?
Good.
Good. Back about 1966, I was involved in a coffee house in Logan Square. We had a guy come in from, he was a naval officer, came in and he gave us a little talk about Vietnam. And he told me, told us, that the main reason why France was interested in Vietnam and now we were interested is that Vietnam was the major producer of rice in Asia. And it was, you know, billions of tons of rice a year that they were shipping out. And, you know, it's to protect the food of Europe or of Asia. I mean, I'm sorry.
I get it. But they didn't mention that. You know, they didn't say petroleum. They didn't say rice. They said communism. It was our fear about that. But that's what you heard back in the day, huh?
Yeah, well, they were afraid that the communists were going to get the rice.
Well, now that does make that does make sense. Doug, are you watching the series at all?
No, I haven't. I haven't watched it.
Yeah, well, you might. I mean, or you might not. I'm not going to advocate for it, not having seen it all. It sure sounds profound, and all of the reviews are good, and we've enjoyed it, but it's certainly a patient series so far, I'll say that. Doug, I appreciate your phone call. Paul, this is John. Jump in here. You're on WGN. What can I do for you?
Hey, John. I'm your Orion Samuelson impersonator from years ago. But
wait a minute. Let's hear it.
Good afternoon, John. Today's afternoon report brought to you in part by the letter C for cow. Anyway, so I tried out for that, and my girlfriend tried out for that back in April of this year. It's actually done by Kat Edmondson.
Wait a minute. The Toyota ad?
The Camry. Yes, the Camry commercial.
No kidding. You guys sang a version of that song?
Yes, we tried out for it. Our agency out in Milwaukee said, hey, there's this new Camry commercial, and we tried out for it. And eventually they gave it to Kat to do. And it's strictly for an agency out, though, in L.A. I think it's Saatchi & Saatchi out in Los Angeles.
Kat Edmondson you're talking about.
Commercial.
Yeah.
She's the one that does Lucky.
No kidding. So that's Kat Edmondson. And does that song exist outside of the commercial? Can I find an unedited version of her a cappella singing that?
Not yet, but I will tell you this, that the agency is getting blown up, and there's a possibility, just rumor, that they could have her back in the studio by October to actually record a full version of it because it's just blowing up all over the place.
Isn't it good?
It's a gorgeous, it's just awesome. It's a beautiful, gorgeous, sweet, sexy, sassy little pouty version of that song. It's just so much flavor in that song. So yeah. And that's what that's actually what I just explained it as. That's what they were looking for in the read that we got for it was that's what they wanted, this pouty little relaxed.
So what did your version sound like? What did your version sound like, Paul?
I don't know. I forgot. I forgot.
Well, you didn't lose to a bad winner, I'll say that. All right, we'll try and track this down still and follow this. Chime in anytime when you find out more, okay?
We'll do that. Thanks, John.
Thanks for listening. We'll continue to use the resources at Northern Illinois University in this half hour. We'll start with Walker Ashley, who's been on with us before, the meteorologist, talking hurricanes. He's really good. As we get to him, though, I just want to pop in one quick call, and that's from Ron, who got us down the Vietnam path yesterday. Hey, Ron, it's John. How are you again?
Good, John. Thank you for letting me talk again. You know, I have to come from a different perspective. You know, as a 19-year-old kid who dropped his four-year deferment for sheet metal apprenticeship to go to Vietnam because I knew it was the wrong thing. You know, I didn't go to no college. Of course, we had the 68 convention. I didn't participate. I had friends from high school who did. I had friends who were National Guard who were fighting. I was playing football with them, semi-pro. So I didn't want to go. You know, I didn't want to get beat up by the cops. But I knew the war was wrong from reading underground newspapers like The Seed and also the Black Panther Party. So with Tet and Walter Cronkite, that sealed the deal. I had to go. I just had to go, and I was anti-war going in.
Have you watched the first three episodes?
Yes, I have, and it's been pretty good, but it's still got a slant. It's got a slant, pro-CIA. I'm sorry, you know, like I said before, they said the South Vietnamese generals decided to assassinate Diem in a coup. And, come on, the CIA told them what to do. Nothing went down.
All right, here's what I'm going
to
do. I'm behind an episode, so I'm going to catch up with you, and I'm going to, you know, each day we'll just kind of take a few calls, read a few texts on this, but you're the one that suggested that we do this. We played back that segment that you talked about. I don't know if you heard that.
Yes, I did, John. One final point, if I may. You know, getting over to Vietnam, the first book I picked up in a transient station was the autobiography of Ho Chi Minh. And I found out Ho Chi Minh and his Viet Minh helped my father, who served 3 years in the Pacific, 4 bronze battle stars, survive the Japanese. You know, not only was I anti-war, but this guy helped my father survive World War II.
Well, you must be happy with the fact. All right, I got to go, Ron. I appreciate your call. But, I mean, you must appreciate the fact that in the series, they tell the story of Ho Chi Minh. And, you know, it's quite possible that if we hadn't screwed that up, he would have been an ally for us. The problem became that the South Vietnamese were so incompetent and corrupt that as we were fighting the North Vietnamese with the South Vietnamese, we had to throw in with people who were no good, and we knew it. Our situation was untenable. Okay, more about that tomorrow. Let's talk to Walker Ashley, the meteorologist at Northern Illinois University. Obviously, I want to talk a little bit about hurricane season again. Hey, Walker, thanks for jumping on with us again. I'll take 5 minutes of your time. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well.
So here we go again. This is the third conversation you and I have had and the third monster hurricane, right?
Yeah, it's like Bill Murray and Groundhog Day, huh?
Yeah, about that. This one, though, while it hits Puerto Rico, then kind of bounces off, and we're not going to have to worry about this one anymore, right?
Well, I don't want to throw it out to sea quite yet. It's not a 0% chance it won't affect the United States, at least the lower 48. Recall that U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico are territories of the United States, so we can't forget that fact. But it does look, at least the forecast track is right now, to hang off just the east coast of the United States. We'll have rip currents and unfortunately, there's probably some coastal flooding associated with it. Wow. But it's going to be a fairly close call, so we need to pay attention to it.
Warmer oceans make stronger hurricanes. Is that the moral of these stories again?
Well, I mean, these are the basic ingredients that we need for hurricanes. The Atlantic has been a heck of an incubator this year, and you definitely need warm sea surface temperatures. And the bath water in the Caribbean, Eastern Caribbean, has been upper 80s to near 90. And so that is a primary condition for hurricanes, but also a lack of change in wind direction with height, or what we call wind shear, is a necessity for the sustenance of these storms. So we found those conditions quite prevalent across the Western Atlantic this year.
So do we have a sort of perfect storm, the upper air currents and the warm temperatures to generate these super hurricanes?
Right. Usually we're missing one of the critical ingredients, whether there's just too much wind shear or the sea surface temperatures are just too chilly. In this particular last month, really, since the mid to latter part of August, of course, going back to Harvey, the environment has just been very conducive to these high-end tropical storms.
Last year, we didn't have a bunch of super hurricanes. We've kind of missed. It hasn't been this bad for the last few years, though, right?
Yeah, we've been relatively lucky, and so again, we're missing one of the critical ingredients. Maybe we didn't have enough disturbances coming off of Africa, which are typically the seedlings for these for these hurricane events, or maybe even factors such as the amount of dust that comes off of Africa can directly influence hurricane formation. And last year in particular, we had a lot of dry air in the Atlantic Basin and in the mid-levels of the atmosphere, and that is not conducive to hurricane development.
Do you have any advice for those of us who find ourselves getting into climate change arguments with our friends on how to use these three hurricanes?
Well, we have to be cautious with that, right? I wish that we would get a little bit more argumentative regarding some of the policies that we have out there. Building and subsidizing development
right.
in areas maybe where a little risky. But it's good to have these discussions. It's healthy. I would invite people to become informed. Just don't listen to Uncle Bob or even Brother John. Become informed and read, science. And there's plenty of avenues out there to receive some of that information.
And however you come to, for whatever reason, for whatever conclusion you come to,
that's the truth.
The reason that you and I first spoke was that if you're the mayor of a city near a body of water on the ocean on the East Coast, you need to start paying attention to infrastructure and stuff like that, right?
Oh, yeah. You should have been thinking about that during the mayoral race. It is, coastlines all across the globe are going to be dealing with the sea level rise, and we've seen about three and a half inches since the mid-1990s. That's supposed to accelerate throughout the 21st century, and some of the projections are for up to 4 feet of sea level rise. And so you think of Miami, Charleston, Houston, New York City, and on and on and on. We're going to have to really think about policy and using technology for our advantage.
Nice to talk to you, Walker. I'll call you again another day. We always appreciate your time and expertise, sir.
Thanks, John.
Walker Ashley is at Northern Illinois University, a professor there, a meteorologist. One of his colleagues, Paul Stoddard, is an earthquake expert. I've got a couple questions for him. Like, what are the chances? Is there something to the fact that you have, these gigantic earthquakes on the same day, 1 year apart, and two around an 8-point-something within several days of each other? And what does this say to California? He'll answer those questions in a minute. Paul Stoddard's on a phone line, another one of the smart people over at Northern Illinois University, an expert on geology and earthquakes. Hey, Paul, it's John Williams. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. I got like three simple questions for you, and you get about 3 minutes to answer them. You ready?
All right.
What about the coincidence of a super-duper earthquake on the same day? Is there something to the date, or is that just a 1 in 365 chance?
Well, maybe it's a 1 in 90 chance, but there is some evidence to suggest that there's a certain seasonality to earthquakes. Rainy seasons might see more of them, but as for the specific day itself, yeah, that's pure coincidence.
So does a couple of really severe earthquakes, though, because we had that other one that was off the coast of Mexico, right, that was an 8-point-something?
Yeah, that was about an 8.0 in 1985. It did an awful lot of damage. It really devastated a lot of buildings. It killed a lot of people, unfortunately. Both of these are related to subduction of the Cocos Plate under Mexico. So subduction zones are really prime areas for getting large earthquakes. And so both of these are related to that type of activity.
Did they know this one was? Did they know this was coming? Don't they have sensors that say the pressure's really high here? Did they see this one coming?
Unfortunately, earthquake prediction is not yet very good. So we know that areas are prone to have earthquakes. That allows for better building codes to minimize the damage and death that happens during an earthquake. But in terms of predicting one so that you could evacuate a city or do something like that, we're still pretty far away from being able to achieve that. It seems like every region is a little different, and having a big earthquake can actually change the circumstances so that even if you figured out what was happening with that first earthquake, the earthquake itself might have changed things enough so that you couldn't figure out
right.
from that what to do with the next one.
Is it possible that, though, that since the Earth has relieved all that pressure with this big earthquake in Mexico, that they're sort of off the hook for a while? Or is it possible this is just a precursor of things to come?
Either of those is possible. Unfortunately, we don't have a very good way to figure out which is right. So, yeah, it could have relieved a lot of pressure. It could have, by slipping where it did, might be putting more pressure on neighboring areas. So maybe it will be the precursor to a bigger event in the next few days or weeks. There's really no way to tell. Generally, an earthquake this large is the big event, but sometimes it is what we call a foreshock to an even bigger one.
You could have a 7 or 8.0 foreshock?
Yeah, you could.
What does this tell the people in California? Is what happens in Mexico in any way related to San Francisco?
Only in a very gross general sense. In terms of any predictions they might be making or any alerts or anything like that in San Francisco, really no relationship whatsoever.
Your colleague a moment ago was on our show, Walker Ashley, the meteorologist, and he did say something to us a couple of weeks ago, that places like Miami are just sitting ducks, that eventually, you know, the Category 4 or 5 hurricane is going to hit, and they will suffer the consequences. Do you feel
right.
the same way, though, about earthquakes in Southern California or Northern California?
Absolutely. We know they happened there. We know why they happened there. We know they will happen there again. So, yeah, it is just a matter of time. But fortunately, because we do know that, like I said, we can, you know, build buildings to tighter construction codes. We have a pretty good idea of the nature of motion that a building undergoes during an earthquake. And we can design buildings, and they're very clever out in California about doing this, buildings on giant shock absorbers, on wheels,
yeah.
and so forth to minimize the amount of shaking that takes place.
I'm out of time. I suppose I'll be calling you again. Thanks for your help this afternoon, Paul, and we'll stay in touch, okay?
All right, my pleasure.
Paul Stoddard is a professor of geology and expert on earthquakes.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
At 208, this is John. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. You know, I'm looking at the list of Let Us Entertain You restaurants. If I read it to you, you might not be here by the time I get done with the list. You'll also be very hungry. Wow.
You know what it's like listening to old records, too,
it
though?
It kind of is.
Because you have an association with so many of them.
Exactly. Antico Posto. Oh, been there, done that. Now I want to tell you about my Antico Posto experience. Beatrix, Big Bull, Bub City, Community Canteen, Don and Charlie's, El Segundo, Everest. Hello, Everest. Have you ever been to Everest, Steve Bertrand?
I have not.
I have a better chance of getting on top of Mount Everest than I do getting a seat at Everest. Frankie Scalapini. Il Porcinello, Pucciolino, Joe's Seafood, Joe's Seafood Prime Steak and Stone Crab, the Lettuce at Navy Pier, Mighty Nice Bar and Grill, Petterino's, RJ Grunts, Shaw's Crab House. I'm just the True. Hello, True. Wildfires, very nice, like that. Eiffel Tower, Emma Cafe Cafe Barbariba. Some of them are kind of funny, though. Lucky Dumpling, Chinese pickup and delivery.
Do they have the date of birth and date of death in some of them?
I know. I think these are the ones that are still up and running.
Really?
So, because I don't see some of the ones that we've come to know and love over the years. The one I was telling you about is on that list, too, though, and that is the Osterio Via Stato. I think that's it. I just saw it a second ago. Really good Italian. I like that. Let's see here. I got to stop looking at this list.
you get distracted, don't you? I mean, I know you do. What a stupid thing to say. But if you got lost for an hour and a half last night listening to different versions of What a Wonderful World, and now we put a list of restaurants in front of you, you're gone.
Right. Well, now because I'm going down memory lane.
Right.
I'm going, oh, yeah, I remember that. Ooh, and then my mind starts going from there to things that you think about when you think of restaurants, music or meals, and then family. And the next thing you know, you're looking up the history of forks. and you realize you haven't shaved in a day.
Ken Burns is doing a film on forks.
He probably could. So there was a story in the Tribune the other day about this couple that several months ago, or at least this guy, was on his way back to the United States from Hawaii. He was on a Hawaiian Airlines flight, and he was mad about something. I tried to click around and find a little bit more about it. And I believe what got this guy upset was that he did not have a blanket. And when he asked for a blanket, they said, yeah, but it'll be $12. And then he threw a complete conniption. So they had to deter the flight and land somewhere else. And then when you think about what the expense is to the airline and the inconvenience to all the passengers, we've got to start to do something about unruly passengers. And the fine for this guy was $100,000. And in the Tribune, they said maybe this will start to impress upon people the fact that however upset you may be about where you're sitting or who's sitting next to you or is there not room enough on the plane for you or the charge for a blanket, you just can't do that. $100,000 for a guy, I'm led to believe, doesn't have $100,000 laying around.
So if you're going to wig out over a $12 blanket, which I understand, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, that's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous.
That is ridiculous.
But if you're going to go out of control, are you going to be checked by the idea that you might be fined $100,000 a year later?
I don't know. What's the answer to that?
I say no. You're going to wig out if you're wig outable.
I think that's true. They talk about that when they talk about capital punishment and how that will keep people from committing terrible crimes. But people always do. They still shoot each other and stab each other. So I tend to go down that road with you. But that's because you're so mad you're going to kill somebody. Don't you think you're so mad that you're going to be upset about a blanket charge and $100,000 is on the other side?
I think if someone charges me $12 for a blanket, I start to get mad about everything and getting re-mad about everything for the rest of my, you know, throughout my life. It all sort of explodes at that moment.
Oh, right.
I mean,
so
that's what happens.
Really? So there's a lot of people walking around who are just a $12 blanket charge away.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
And, you know, and the poor flight attendants and pilots and co-pilots, they're the ones that are handed this baggage, right? You get on a tube that goes 30,000 feet in the air, and they don't know what they got. Like, if we all had little gauges on our necks, and it showed how close we were to popping, you know, red, yellow, green.
$3 blanket, $12 blanket.
You want to be in the green. I have a gauge on my gas tank for my grill. It's in green right now. It means I'm good. But when it gets to yellow or red, I know I've got to fix this right now. If we had gauges like that on our necks, they could go, don't charge that guy for a blanket. He's at 94%. He could pop. Sarah Nelson's on the phone, or at least she was. She's the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants. Sarah, this is John Williams, and you're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Hi, very good. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for listening to our little conversation there. Why don't you jump in? What do you want to say, having heard what you just heard?
Well, look, we worked very hard in the early 2000s to increase the fines for crew member interference and also penalties. And we were successful in getting that in place in 2003. So an international study this year that came out by IATA shows that unruly passenger incidents have been on the rise worldwide. But actually, in the U.S., they've gone down. It's the only country where they've gone down. And you know, to your point about is this a deterrent or not with these potential fines, I think it is. And I think that talking about this in the media, because there has been a lot of conversation around that in the media, has helped to keep people from acting out, because they know that if you're going to act out on a plane, there's going to be big problems. And that does, I think, keep some people from acting out. But there's other things that need to be done, too. I mean, this is we talk about this all the time as flight attendants. More and more, we have to de-escalate conflicts
right on
board, because you've got people sitting closer together than ever before. Anytime you have that kind of human contact, something's bound to go wrong.
Yeah.
And the airlines are, you know, charging people for everything, as you were talking about earlier, putting these seats closer together so that people are uncomfortable. And it's a recipe for problems. This guy was also drinking. And let's be clear. I mean, he didn't just get mad. He assaulted the crew members. So that's what he was fined for. That's why they turned the plane around. And when these things happen, this is a very serious concern for everyone on board. So they wanted to get that airplane on the ground to make sure this wasn't a bigger problem. We're also trained that sometimes this can be a tactic to try to distract us from a larger security issue. We take these things really seriously because people can get really hurt. You're in a small space. There's no place to go. There's no way to call for help. There's no way to remove the problem unless you get on the ground. So all those people on that jumbo jet were disserviced too. And the $100,000 didn't even begin to cover the costs that the airlines incurred over this. But hopefully, you know, hopefully this guy will learn his lesson, and maybe some others will think in the back of their minds before they start out on this. But I'll tell you something else. We are working to make sure that passengers have a more comfortable ride and that they have a safer ride. So there's a an act in Congress right now called the SEAT Act. It's the Safe Egress and Air Travel Act. And what this will do is it's going to study the impact of seat pitch on safety. So as these seats are getting closer together, we have some concerns about people actually being able to get out of the plane in an emergency. And if we can have some standards where airlines can no longer shrink that seat pitch, that's going to help everyone. So there's things that we're doing to try to alleviate the problem and advocate for passengers, too.
If you can use safety as a reason to make the airplanes more comfortable, because to me that's a little bit of the, you know, egg and the chicken here. To me, the chicken is let's make the seats more comfortable. And we all know it's an economic decision. The airlines just want to get more people in the same tube. But if we can say, aha, but now we can't get out in the case of an emergency, use safety as the reason to make them more comfortable. I'm not doubting what you're saying. I suppose safety is an issue, too. But I'd be glad if you could use that just to make them more comfortable for the rest of us. Because you're right. It's ridiculously tight. And if the person in front of you wants to put their seat back, forget about it. You're in misery for the whole flight.
That's right. So I think that people take for granted that they're going to have a safe flight. And that's because we have worked really hard to make the safest travel system in the world, U.S. aviation. And so people take that for granted, but you don't take it for granted if something goes wrong with your flight or you lose a loved one.
Well,
so
do you know,
safety's top priority.
In this $100,000 case, the Chicago Tribune author of that one column didn't talk much about the details. It sounds like you know a little bit more about that case. Do you know much more about that case? The $100,000
Hawaiian Airlines? I don't have intimate knowledge, but I certainly have read up on what happened on board. Mm-hmm.
And so he was angry. Was that the blanket incident, or was he angry about something else?
Well, he was threatening his family. He was threatening the flight attendants. I mean, this guy was truly out of control. And he may have given the excuse of the blanket, but that's not in the crux of the complaint here.
Yeah.
He was drinking. He was drinking before he got on board. He was drinking once he got on board. He actually claims that he doesn't remember the incident. So that should give you a clue about what kind of state he was in. And, you know, these things happen. Part of the problem is that people sit in airports sometimes waiting on delayed flights, and what they do is they drink a little bit more. Or, you know, people just have it in their minds that that's what you do when you go fly, and then they're not very accustomed to how their body reacts to the pressurized air and the lack of oxygen that's also included in that.
Oh, yeah.
And how the alcohol is going to react in their bodies.
How
so,
hard is it?
You know, some people don't make very good decisions.
How hard is it for you all to tell passengers, no, you're not going to get another drink?
Well, it's really hard, and let me tell you, we do have alcohol training, and we do try to avoid over-serving anyone, and we'll try to cut back when someone has had too much. When they get on our planes, though, and we don't really know how much they've had before they get there, it's very hard. And it's harder than ever today because our staffing has been cut to minimum. So there's fewer flight attendants, more passengers than ever, and the ratio of flight attendants to passengers is much less. And so we don't have the ability to communicate as well with each other. Sometimes, you know, we try to let each other know when we see that somebody's maybe getting to that point of needing to be cut off. And if we don't have the opportunity to go talk with each other because we're so busy serving the rest of the cabin, that can get in the way also of our ability in managing the situation. So alcohol is a big problem, and we, you know, we're in a tougher spot in dealing with it.
In the Tribune yesterday, they said in the last 12 months, 40% of airlines, 40% of airlines had to divert a flight because of a passenger behaving badly. Drinking and drugs seem to play an instrumental role in many of these incidents, with at least 23% of all reported cases being linked to such substance abuse. I'm surprised it's not higher than that. But, you know, the most celebrated case of this of late, it seems to me, Sarah Nelson's on the phone. And she is the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants, is that crazy Dr. David Dow. the guy who was pulled screaming off an airplane. It resonated here in Chicago. And then later got back on the plane, bloodied and talking out of his head. I don't know if you have something to say about that case, but I think that's the other side of this equation. I think a lot of us think that the passengers are behaving badly. We're also not sure that the crews have a good grip on what to do. So let's pick it up there in a minute. That's them dragging Dr. Dow off that United Airlines flight. He was acting oddly. They dragged him off. And the weird thing is, you remember that scream and the reaction of the people and then what happened to the airline and everybody as a result. I mean, it really was a weeks-long story. Do you remember, though, that after he got dragged off, for some reason, he was able to get back on the plane. He's bloodied now, and he's running up and down the aisle.
Just kill me. Kill me. Relax, relax, kill me. Relax. Can you go on? I have to go home.
Running up and down
the
aisle of the plane, and he's screaming, just kill me, just kill me. I have to go home. It seemed to me like that guy needed to get off of that airplane. We're talking with Sarah Nelson. She is the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants. The reason we called her up was the story in the Tribune the other day about the unruly passenger on a flight from Hawaii to New York City. He was fined $100,000, and the hope is that those severe fines are going to check some crazy behavior. Sarah, what's the lesson learned from that story of Dr. Dow?
Well, the Dr. Dow story was a complete nightmare, and it's not representative of what flight crews do every day. And I should be really clear that flight crews had no part in dragging him off of the plane.
That's true.
And following on to that, you're right. That was a media frenzy for a week, and it followed on to other passengers sending in other videos and making other claims. And it was a very, very difficult time for flight crews because we're there for the safety, health, and security of the passengers in our care. We're the biggest advocates for passengers because our workspace is your travel space. And so we want it to be really good. But following on to that event, flight attendants were coming to work with an incredible amount of angst because just doing basic safety checks, making sure people have their seatbelts on, making sure that their seats are upright, that their luggage is stowed, they were getting comments like, what are you going to do if I don't do it? Drag me out of here? And it created this atmosphere on our planes that was quite unsafe and quite unsettling for the flight crews who are charged with keeping order in the cabin and keeping a safe space for everyone on that plane. That incident never should have happened, completely unacceptable. Any flight crew would tell you that. And I think that we have to remember that United Airlines alone carries the population the size of the city of Chicago every single day. And all of those flights would not get up in the air without a vent if it were not for the expert work of the flight attendants who are de-escalating conflict, resolving problems, and making sure that people have a safe, efficient flight.
Well, that's that word again, de-escalation. Police forces across the country are being trained in that. And I think it'd be great if airline staffs can learn to de-escalate situations. But doggone it, passengers need to de-escalate their crap, too. Everybody needs to just be a little more accommodating, have your life a little less than perfect when you get in a shared space like that.
Yeah, we really encourage people to come to the airplane with a sense of community. We're really in this together from one point to the next. And, it's not comfortable for anybody having to sit with other people. Everybody has a different feeling about how that's going to go and whether or not they like it and which seat they like to sit in and whether or not they even like to be up in the air. You know, there's a lot of people who have some real angst about that. So we need everyone's help. And I should note that Hawaiian Airlines flight, the flight attendants had to direct other passengers to help restrain the passenger because he was so out of control. So the idea when you come to the airplane that we're all in this together, we're going to get there safely and efficiently, and we're all going to treat each other with respect, it will take us a long way to have a better experience when we travel.
Well, isn't that well put? It's nice to talk to you. My best to everybody that does what you do, Sarah. Thanks for helping us out this afternoon. We'll call you again another day too, okay?
Appreciate it. Love WGN.
Thanks, Sarah. That's Sarah Nelson. She's the international president of the Association of Flight Attendants. And this segment, I want to play for you a little bit of what Jimmy Kimmel said in his monologue last night. And to sort of keep score on it all is Elizabeth Rosenthal joining us again, the editor-in-chief at Kaiser Health News. Elizabeth, it's John Williams. How are you this afternoon?
I'm good. Thanks for having me again.
I want to play a couple of clips, and you tell me what's fact or fiction in all of this, okay?
Okay.
So Jimmy Kimmel is talking about another attempt by the Senate to eliminate or change Obamacare. So what's the new health care bill going to look like? Senator Bill Cassidy from Louisiana and Senator Lindsey Graham both came up with something that Jimmy Kimmel is not happy about, and this is him talking about it.
A senator named Bill Cassidy from Louisiana was on my show for coming up with something. He named it this, the Jimmy Kimmel test, which was, in a nutshell, no family should be denied medical care, emergency or otherwise, because they can't afford it. He agreed to that. He said he would only support a health care bill that made sure a child like mine would get the health coverage he needs no matter how much money his parents make. And that did not have annual or lifetime caps. These insurance companies, they want caps to limit how much they can pay out. So, for instance, if your son has to have three open heart surgeries, it can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars apiece. If he hits his lifetime cap of, let's say, $1 million, the rest of his life, he's on his own. Now, our current plan protects Americans from these caps and prevents insurance providers from jacking up the rates for people who have pre-existing conditions of all types. And Senator Cassidy said his plan would do that, too.
Would the child born with a congenital heart disease be able to get everything she or he would need in that first year of life? I wanted to pass the Jimmy Kimmel test.
That's the test that they called it that. Jimmy Kimmel's son famously went through heart surgery. He talked a lot about that and then the need for us to have equitable, fair, and universal health care. So what are you hearing in that, Elizabeth? Is Jimmy Kimmel on to something? Was he speaking the truth so far?
Yes, so far. I think Jimmy Kimmel is right on in his analysis. I mean, basically, I think many people are happy with their health care until they have a sick kid or get sick themselves, and then they really understand the nuts and bolts of how it works and what doesn't work. So what we see in the new bill is not outright federal abdication of this responsibility, but kind of throwing it back to the states, saying, okay, you can loosen these prohibitions against excluding or charging people with pre-existing conditions more. You can sell insurance that has a lifetime cap. You can do what you want through waivers. And you know what? The thing is, some states will do that, and that will leave people very, very, very vulnerable, because like Obamacare or not, two of the really, really important things it did for people was it prohibited insurers for excluding or charging people more who had pre-existing conditions, and also it prohibited those lifetime caps. And in our very, very expensive medical system, you don't have to have a big pre-existing condition to be excluded or priced out of health care, and you don't have to be very sick to go over $1 million lifetime cap. A kid with a congenital heart condition will do it really, really quickly.
Okay, here's more Jimmy Kimmel then.
Okay, so last week, Bill Cassidy and Senator Lindsey Graham proposed a new bill, the Graham-Cassidy bill. And this new bill actually does pass the Jimmy Kimmel test, but a different Jimmy Kimmel test. With this one, your child with a pre-existing condition will get the care he needs if and only if his father is Jimmy Kimmel. Otherwise, you might be screwed. He said he wants coverage for all, no discrimination based on pre-existing conditions, lower premiums for middle-class families, and no lifetime caps. And guess what? The new bill does none of those things. Coverage for all? No. In fact, it'll kick about 30 million Americans off insurance. Pre-existing conditions? Nope. If the bill passes, individual states can let insurance companies charge you more if you have a pre-existing condition. You'll find that little loophole later in the document after it says they can't. They can and they will. But will it lower premiums? Well, in fact, for lots of people, the bill will result in higher premiums. And as far as no lifetime caps go, the states can decide on that, too, which means there will be lifetime caps.
Elizabeth Rosenthal, what do you think about that?
Sounds right to me. I think one of the things we have to remember is that when we talk about pre-existing conditions, we're not, in fact, just talking about someone like Jimmy Kimmel's son, who has, you know, quite a major cardiac condition that is correctable, that will be corrected, but is very expensive. We have to remember that before insurers could exclude people with pre-existing conditions, they were excluding people who had a history of an abnormal pap smear, who needed an asthma inhaler. So if you think this just impacts people who have kids with really serious diseases, you're wrong. It will impact all of us. And I think that's why I admire Jimmy Kimmel for using his family's hardship and his son's medical challenges to educate the citizenry on this topic.
But this Graham bill, the will do the things that Jimmy Kimmel said? I mean, he's accurately describing the potential consequences of it?
Well, they are the potential consequences, and that's kind of where the Republicans buy themselves wiggle room, right? They don't say, you can do this. They say, we're going to leave it up to states if these things are going to be enforced and how they're going to be enforced and what's going to be mandated of insurance plans. So one of the things, again, that the ACA did was to have standard insurance plans, so you couldn't sell what are called skinny plans, you know, that maybe didn't cover maternity, maybe didn't cover drug costs. And fine, you know, people will say, I'm not going to get pregnant, or maybe I won't need expensive drugs. But the thing about health care is you don't know what's going to happen next week or next year. So, which is why Obamacare wanted good, full, rounded coverage for everyone.
Even if as a male, you were never going to pay for gynecological care, right? Or
yeah, but as I point out to males, they all were born. So they benefited from maternity care.
Somehow
too.
Or another, they did touch that topic. Okay, so here's Jimmy Kimmel again.
They're trying to sneak this scam of a bill they cooked up in without an analysis from the bipartisan Congressional Budget Office. They don't even want you to see it. They're having one hearing. The hearings, I read the hearings being held in the Homeland Security Committee, which has nothing to do with health care. And the chairman agreed to allow two witnesses, Bill Cassidy and Lindsey Graham, to speak. So listen, health care is complicated. It's boring. I don't want to talk about it. The details are confusing. And that's what these guys are relying on. They're counting on you to be so overwhelmed with all the information, you just trust them to take care of you. But they're not taking care of you. They're taking care of the people who give them money.
Is this not getting a fair hearing or a public enough vetting?
Well, you know, this has been a complaint of the Democrats all along. And in fact, it's a complaint of many of the Republicans who oppose this, too. So I don't think this is a partisan thing entirely. Healthcare is very complicated. This bill and the many versions of GOP health reform have been pushed through really quickly without the customary hearings, what we would refer to as regular order in the Senate. So they haven't had the kind of in-depth analysis that healthcare, which is 20% of our GDP, deserves. And also, more importantly, it's our health. It's our kids' health. So I think, you know, there are a lot of people on both sides of the aisle who think what we really need to do is back up and think hard about how we want to improve the health system we have. Or fine, if you want to reform it and remake it radically, let's think about that. But let's think about it in a slow, rational way so that people aren't harmed. We haven't even on this particular bill, and you know this may be a deal breaker. Heard from the Congressional Budget Office, you may remember the last two Republican bills got terrible scores from the Congressional Budget Office, saying that you know tens of millions more people would be uninsured, and the premiums, especially for those with pre-existing conditions, were likely to skyrocket. So that pretty much ended those bills for some Republicans, and I think for Senator McCain, who ultimately had to vote against it. So, you know, what will happen with the CBO score on this one? Hard to say, right? If it gets a great CBO score, maybe it will find new life, but I suspect it employs many of the concepts that had bad scores earlier. So we're waiting to see how that happens.
Yeah, he said that it would throw 30 million people off. We'll wait for the CBO score on that. But he is also, I think, onto something, suggesting that we're going to reach a point of fatigue. If President Trump just keeps hammering away long enough and hard enough, he just came off what some people saw as a strong United Nations speech. And so maybe all of a sudden there'll be this little crack and they'll get this thing through. How likely is it, in your estimation, that this Cassidy-Graham bill will pass?
Well, you know, we journalists don't like to play odds on these kind of things, especially with Congress in the state it's in right now. So I wouldn't go there, but I will say that there is a lot. We hear there's a lot of fatigue on the Hill. They don't want to deal with this. Remember, a lot of the states have Republican governors who don't want to be seen as throwing their constituents off health insurance. It's likely to I would suspect, not get a very good CBO score. So I think the odds are against this one pulling through. And as someone who really cares passionately about health care, I have to say the thing that bothers me the most is the discussion around this is not the one Jimmy Kimmel is talking about, which is this good for sick kids? Is this good for people with pre-existing conditions? Instead, it's like this, vote counting in the Senate, who owes who what favor. And that's a really bad basis for a health care bill. It shouldn't be because you're Republican or Democrat or because you're a fiscal conservative or, pro-tax, anti-tax. It should really be about health care. And that's the last thing, it seems, on people's minds. It's an afterthought until Jimmy Kimmel brings it up on late-night TV.
Here's the last clip from Jimmy Kimmel last night.
Most of the Congress people who voted on this bill probably won't even read it. And they want us to do the same thing. They want us to treat it like an iTunes service agreement. And this guy, Bill Cassidy, just lied right to my face. Do you believe that every American, regardless of income, should be able to get regular checkups, maternity care, et cetera, all of those things that people who have health care get and need?
Yep.
So yep is Washington for nope, I guess. And I never imagined I would get involved in something like this. This is not my area of expertise. My area of expertise is eating pizza, and that's really about it. But we can't let him do this to our children and our senior citizens and our veterans and or to any of us. And by the way, before you post a nasty Facebook message saying I'm politicizing my son's health problems, I want you to know I am politicizing my son's health problems because I have to. But my family has health insurance. We don't have to worry about this, but other people do. So you can shove your disgusting comments where your doctor won't be giving you a prostate exam once they take your health care benefits away.
Yeah, you're on, Elizabeth.
I'm glad he's bringing this message to the American people because I think he's doing a reality check for all of us. You know, we hear from the Senate, this bill will be good for you. You'll get the care you need in an emergency. It won't cost you anything more. You know, we heard the repeal and replace refrain all through the first 6 months of this presidency. We hear the single payer refrain from the Democratic side. But I think we really need to get down to brass tacks. And what does this mean for a sick child? And that's what Jimmy Kimmel, I think, has refocused us on. And I hope we move from there and focus on those kids rather than on political jockeying when we move forward.
Our text messages include when in history to become the U.S. government's responsibility for people's health care. From the 847 area code regarding pre-existing conditions, I wish I could buy my car insurance after I had a car accident. And this one from 815 says, as a Republican, the pre-existing condition clause needs to stay. My wife has MS. Her medicine is $5,000 a month. Just a few of the text messages. All right.
Yep, we all have pre-existing conditions. I think that's the message here, or we all could. So, to me, health insurance and making sure everyone has good health insurance is like making sure everyone who lives in a hurricane zone has good flood insurance, because sooner or later you're going to need it, and you don't want to be excluded.
Well, the big picture of this, last thing I'll ask you to comment on, then we do have to go, they're throwing it back to the states. And I don't think that in and of itself is a terrible thing. But Jimmy Kimmel is suggesting that just as sure as it goes to the states and they get to decide what is and isn't included, there will be a lot of people that will not be covered for pre-existing conditions. There will be a lot of people that see higher premiums. There will be a lot of people with lifetime caps, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, because the states are going to have to do this with limited money. I mean, the whole point of this is to cut down the amount we spend on health care. And, depending on your political bent, depending on, this whole narrative about is health care a right or is it a privilege, different state legislatures have taken very different positions. And I kind of say, well, it's not a right or a privilege. It's just a necessity. You know, when you're 8 months pregnant, you're going to have the baby. It's not about rights or privilege. If you're 65 and having crushing chest pain, a hospital is going to treat you. It's not about rights or privilege. It's about, we're human and we need to take care of ourselves.
Find out more at Kaiser Health News. The editor-in-chief there is Elizabeth Rosenthal. I'm going to call you again, Elizabeth. As always, thank you so very much. Anna DeVlantis in the studio.
Hi there, John.
What's going on?
Well, we've got Skilling coming up pretty close off the top of our show today as we're tracking Maria. She's Puerto Rico 100% without power.
I just saw that. No electricity on that whole island.
If you see any light there at all, it is a backup generator. And they say the eye has already moved on, but the winds certainly haven't. The flooding is the next leg of the concern here as it moves through the streets, and there is a lot to get to there. So Skilling's going to update us on Maria's path, where it goes next. And also, Alex Stone, we're going to check in on Mexico City. Have you heard the story about the school where there are signs of life and there's a little girl buried? They know she's alive. She waved her hand when the rescue workers asked her to.
Oh, they can see down in there.
They had a camera drop, and one of these dogs that tracks bodies, and they found her, and she's alive. So they're in the process of rescuing her, maybe some other children still alive beneath the rubble. Amazing story of heroics and people coming together there in Mexico City.
What was the name of that little girl that got pulled out of the well years ago?
Oh, my gosh.
Single syllable. Had some vowels. Oh, I can see that now.
I can see it now. I can remember it.
But
they pulled
Jessica? Was it baby Jessica?
Yes, baby Jessica.
Like I said, single syllable, had some vowels. Jessica, three syllables. Mm. So, yeah, I think it was her.
Yeah.
And she did okay. Yeah.
She did. And there are signs of hope here when they find one child alive that potentially in this school there may be others. So they're working feverishly to do that. We're going to check in. Alex Stone will tell us. He's in Mexico City and will deliver the latest news. Their top five of five you won't believe, and some other things we're going to get to, too.